And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Jean Pennell Stevens. Today I'll be reading the book The Sinking of Treehorn by Florence Perry Hyde. Something very strange was happening to Treehorn. The first thing he noticed was that he couldn't reach the shelf in his closet that he had always been able to reach before, the one where he hid his candy bars and bubblegum. Then he noticed that his clothes were getting too big. "My trousers are all stretching or something," said Treehorn to his mother. "I'm tripping on them all the time." "That's too bad, dear," said his mother, looking into the oven. "I do hope this cake isn't going to fall," she said. "And my sleeves come way down below my hand," said Treehorn, "so my shirts must be stretching too." "Think of that," said Treehorn's mother. "I just don't know why this cake isn't rising the way it should. Mrs. Abernally's cakes are always nice. They always rise." Treehorn started out of the kitchen. He tripped on his trousers, which indeed did seem to be getting longer and longer. At dinner that night, Treehorn's father said, "Beef it up, Treehorn. I can hardly see your head." "I am sitting up," said Treehorn. "This is as far up as I come. I think I must be shrinking or something." "I'm sorry my cake didn't turn out very well," said Treehorn's mother. "It's very nice, dear," said Treehorn's father politely. By this time, Treehorn could hardly see over the top of the table. "Sit up, dear," said Treehorn's mother. "I am sitting up," said Treehorn. "It's just that I'm shrinking." "What, dear?" asked his mother. "I'm shrinking, getting smaller," said Treehorn. "If you want to pretend you're shrinking, that's all right," said Treehorn's mother, "as long as you don't do it at the table." "But I am shrinking," said Treehorn. "Don't argue with your mother," said Treehorn's father. "She does look a little smaller," said Treehorn's mother, looking at Treehorn. "Maybe she is shrinking." "Nobody shrinks," said Treehorn's father. "Well, I'm shrinking," said Treehorn. "Look at me." Treehorn's father looked at Treehorn. "Why, you're shrinking," said Treehorn's father. "Look, Emily, Treehorn is shrinking. He's much smaller than he used to be." "Oh, dear," said Treehorn's mother. "First it was the cake and now it's this. Everything happens at once." "I thought I was shrinking," said Treehorn, and he went into the den to turn on the television set. Treehorn liked to watch television. Now he lay on his stomach in front of the television set and watched one of his favorite programs. He had 56 favorite programs. During the commercials, Treehorn always listened to his mother and father talking together, unless they were having a boring conversation. If they were having a boring conversation, he listened to the commercials. Now he listened to his mother and father. "He really is getting smaller," said Treehorn's mother. "What will we do? What will people say?" "Why, they'll say he's getting smaller," said Treehorn's father. He thought for a moment. "I wonder if he's doing it on purpose, just to be different." "Why would he want to be different?" asked Treehorn's mother. Treehorn started listening to the commercial. The next morning, Treehorn was still smaller. His regular clothes were much too big to wear. He rummaged around in his closet until he found some of last year's clothes. They were much too big, too, but he put them on and rolled up the pants and rolled up the sleeves and went down to breakfast. Treehorn liked cereal for breakfast, but mostly he liked cereal boxes. He always read every single thing on the cereal box while he was eating breakfast, and he always sent in for the things in the cereal box that he could send for. In a box in his closet, Treehorn saved all of the things he'd sent in for from several box tops. He had puzzles and special rings and flashlights and pictures of all the presidents and pictures of all the baseball players, and he had pictures of scenes suitable for framing, which he had never framed because he didn't like them very much, and he had all kinds of games and pens and models. Today on the cereal box was a very special offer of a very special whistle that only dogs could hear. Treehorn did not have a dog, but he thought it would be nice to have a whistle that dogs could hear, even if he couldn't hear it. And even if dogs couldn't hear it, it would be nice to have a whistle just to have it. decided to eat all of the cereal in the box so he could send in this morning for the whistle. His mother never let him send in for anything until he had eaten all of the cereal in the box. Treehorn filled in all of the blank spaces for his name and address, and then went to get his money out of the piggy bank on the kitchen counter. But he couldn't reach it. "I certainly am getting smaller," thought Treehorn. He climbed up on a chair and got the piggy bank and shook out a dime. His mother was cleaning the refrigerator. "You know how I hate to have you climb up on the chairs, dear," she said. She went into the living room to dust. Treehorn put the piggy bank in the bottom kitchen drawer. "That way I can get it no matter how little I get," she thought. She found an envelope and put a stamp on it and put the dime in the box top in so he could mail the letter on the way to school. The mailbox was right next to the bus stop. It was hard to walk to the bus stop because his shoes kept slipping off, but he got there in plenty of time, shuffling. He couldn't reach the mailbox slot to put the letter in, so he handed the letter to one of his friends, Mercy, and asked him to put it in. Mercy put it in. "How come you can't mail it yourself, stupid?" asked Mercy. "Because I'm shrinking," explained Treehorn. "I'm shrinking and I'm too little to reach the mailbox." "That's a stupid thing to do," said Mercy. "You're always doing stupid things, but that's the stupidest." When Treehorn tried to get on the school bus, everyone was pushing and shoving. The driver said, "All the way back from the bus stop, all the way back." Then he saw Treehorn trying to climb onto the bus. "Let that little kid on," said the bus driver. Treehorn was helped onto the bus. The bus driver said, "You can stay right up here next to me if you want to, because you're so little." "It's me, Treehorn," said Treehorn to his friend, the bus driver. The bus driver looked down at Treehorn. "You do look like Treehorn at that," he said, "only smaller. Treehorn isn't that little." "I am Treehorn. I'm just getting smaller," said Treehorn. "Nobody gets smaller," said the bus driver. "You must be Treehorn's kid brother. What's your name?" "Treehorn," said Treehorn. "First time I ever heard of a family naming two boys the same name," said the bus driver. "Guess they couldn't think of any other name once they thought of Treehorn." Treehorn said nothing. When he got into class, his teacher said, "Nursery school is down at the end of the hall, honey." "I'm Treehorn," said Treehorn. "If you're Treehorn, why are you so small?" asked the teacher. "Because I'm shrinking," said Treehorn. "I'm getting smaller." "Well, I'll let it go for today," said his teacher. "But these will be taken care of before tomorrow. We don't shrink in this class." After recess, Treehorn was thirsty, so he went down the hall to the water bubbler. He couldn't reach it, and he tried to jump up high enough. He still couldn't get a drink, but he kept jumping up and down, trying. His teacher walked by. "Why, Treehorn," she said, "that isn't like you, jumping up and down in the hall. Just because you're shrinking, it does not mean you have special privileges. What if all the children in the school started jumping up and down in the hall? I'm afraid you'll have to go to the principal's office, Treehorn." So Treehorn went to the principal's office. "I'm supposed to see the principal," said Treehorn to the lady in the principal's outer office. "It's a very busy day," said the lady. "Please check here on this form the reason you have to see him. That will save time. Be sure to put your name down, too. That will save time. And write clearly. That will save time." Treehorn looked at the form. "Check reason you have to see principal. That will save time. 1. Talking in class. 2. Chewing gum in class. 3. Talking back to teacher. 4. Unexcused absence. 5. Unexcused illness. Or 6. Unexcused behavior." There were many things to check, but Treehorn couldn't find one that said being too small to reach the water bubbler. He finally wrote in, "Shrinking." When the lady said he could see the principal, Treehorn went into the principal's office with his form. The principal looked at the form, and then he looked at Treehorn. Then he looked at the form again. "I can't read this," said the principal. "It looks like shrinking. You're not shrinking, are you, Treehorn? You can't have any shrinkers here, you know. We're a team, and we all have to do our very best." "It says shrinking," said Treehorn. "I'm shrinking." "Shrinking, eh?" said the principal. "Well, now, I'm very sorry to hear that, Treehorn. You were right to come to me. That's what I'm here for, to guide. Not to punish, but to guide. To guide all the members of my team to solve all their problems." "But I don't have any problems," said Treehorn. "I'm just shrinking." Well, I want you to know I'm right here when you need me, Treehorn, said the principal, and I'm glad I was here to help you. The team is only as good as its coach, eh? The principal stood up. Goodbye, Treehorn. If you have any more problems, come straight to me and I'll help you again. A problem isn't a problem once it's solved, right? By the end of the day, Treehorn was still smaller. At the dinner table that night, he sat on several cushions so he could be high enough to see over the top of the table. "He's still scratching," sniffed Treehorn's mother. "Heaven knows I've tried to be a good mother."
"Maybe you should call a doctor," said Treehorn's father.
"I did," said Treehorn's mother. "I called every doctor in the Yellow Pages, but no one knew anything about smoking problems." She sniffed again. "Maybe he'll just keep getting smaller and smaller until he disappears."
"No one disappears," said Treehorn's father positively.
"That's right, they don't," said Treehorn's mother more cheerfully. "But no one shrinks either," she said after a moment. "Finish your carrots, Treehorn."
The next morning, Treehorn was so small, he had to jump out of bed. On the floor under the bed was a game he'd pushed under there and forgotten about. He walked under the bed to look at it. It was one of the games he'd sent for from a cereal box. He'd started playing it a couple of days ago, but he hadn't had a chance to finish it because his mother had called him to come right downstairs that minute and have his breakfast, or he'd be late for school. Treehorn looked at the cover of the box. The game was called The Big Game for Kids to Grow On. Treehorn sat under the bed to finish playing the game. He always liked to finish things, even if they were boring. Even if he was watching a boring program on TV, he always watched it right to the end. Games were the same way. He finished this one now. Where had he left off? He remembered he just had to move his piece back 7 spaces on the board when his mother had called him. He was so small now that the only way he could move the spinner was by kicking it. So he kicked it. It stopped at number 4. That meant he could move his piece ahead 4 spaces on the board. The only way he could move the piece forward now was by carrying it. So he carried it. It was pretty heavy. He walked along the board to the 4th space. It said, "Congratulations and up you go. Advance 13 spaces." Treehorn started carrying his piece forward to 13 spaces. But the piece seemed to be getting smaller, or else he was getting bigger. That was it. He was getting bigger, because the bottom of the board was getting close to his head. He pulled the game out from under the bed to finish playing it. He kept moving the piece forward, but he didn't have to carry it any longer. In fact, he seemed to be getting bigger and bigger with each space he landed in. "Well, I don't want to get too big," thought Treehorn. So he moved the piece ahead slowly from one space to the next, getting bigger with each space, until he was his own regular size again. Then he put the spinner and the pieces and the instructions and the board back in the box for the big game for kids to grow on, and put it in his closet. If he ever wanted to get bigger or smaller, he could play it again, even if it was a pretty boring game. Treehorn went down for breakfast and started to read the new cereal box. It said you could send for 100 balloons. His mother was cleaning the living room. She came into the kitchen to get a dust rag. "Don't put your elbows on the table while you're eating, dear," she said. "Look," said Treehorn, "I'm my own size now, my own regular size." "That's nice, dear," said Treehorn's mother. "It's a very nice size, I'm sure, and if I were you, I wouldn't shrink any more. Be sure to tell your father when he comes home tonight. He'll be so pleased." He went back to the living room and started to dust and vacuum. That night, Treehorn was watching TV. As he reached over to change channels, he noticed that his hand was bright green. He looked in the mirror that was hanging over the television set. His face was green, his ears were green, his hair was green. He was green all over. Treehorn sighed. "I don't think I'll tell anyone," he thought to himself. "If I don't say anything, they won't notice." You've been listening to the book The Shrinking of Treehorn by Florence Perry Hyde, published by Holiday House. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella. And I'm Jean Pinnell Stevens.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hassler. Today I'll be reading from the book Serendipity by Stephen Cosgrove. On an iceberg far south in the Antarctic sat an egg. It was no ordinary egg, for it was 4 feet wide and 8 feet tall and had a distinct pink shade to it. Nobody knew what it was. The penguins and the seagulls that lived on the iceberg just assumed that it had been there for a long time, and it probably had. For years and years that egg just sat there, stuck in the ice. But then the iceberg began floating north. The days became warmer, and finally the penguins and the seagulls all packed and went back to the Antarctic because they liked it cold. The egg was left alone on that iceberg, and that iceberg was slowly melting. So one day a curious thing began to happen. The egg that had sat for so many years in the ice twisted and squirmed, crinkled and cracked, and finally hatched. There, standing on wobbly legs and blinking her eyes in the bright sunshine was heaven knows what. She was big, pink, and scared. I guess for all practical purposes you could call her a sea serpent, though she really wasn't. She stood there for a while, just looking at everything there was to see. Suddenly the iceberg rolled with a large wave, and she slipped and slid right into the water. She began floundering about, trying desperately to stay afloat. But since she had just hatched, she didn't know how to swim. She was making so much racket with her splashing and thrashing that a big, fat walrus swam over to see what all the commotion was about.
Who, what are you? Asked the walrus.
I don't know who or what I am, she cried. And with that, she flipped herself upside down. She would have drowned right then and there had not the walrus held her afloat. And as quickly as he could, the big, fat walrus taught her how to swim.
Well, said the walrus, now that you've calmed down a bit, let's see if we can figure out just who you are.
He slowly swam around her, for she was growing even as he was talking.
You're too big to be a tuna and too small to be a whale. You have no feathers, so you can't be a bird. I just don't know what you are.
She began to cry, and cry, and cry. Well, I must be somebody. I don't even have a name.
I may not be able to figure out who or what you are, but I surely can give you a name, said the walrus. From now on, you shall be called, Serendipity. And as you cannot stay here all alone, you will come with me, for I am on my way to the island of Capri, where all the species of all the world are to meet. Possibly they can decide what you are and what you are to do. Now, since Serendipity had nowhere else to go, he decided that yes, he would go with the walrus to that island of Capri. And so they swam and swam into the warmer waters of the Atlantic Ocean. Every day, Serendipity grew just a little bigger, until the walrus was constantly swimming in her shadow. One day, as they were hurrying on their way, they heard cries for help just over the horizon. The two of them quickly swam to investigate. There, right before them, was an aging dolphin trapped in a floating net.
"Oh, how did you get caught in that net?" asked Serendipity. "Oh, I was swimming to the island of Capri," said the dolphin, "when a fisherman threw this net upon me. Now he's gone for help to load me into his boat."
Serendipity turned to the walrus.
"Should we try to help the old dolphin, or should we just hurry on our way?"
"Always help where you can, Serendipity," said the walrus. "And as your name suggests, you will always find valuable things you are not looking for."
Serendipity agreed, and soon the walrus set about trying to free the dolphin. But while they were busy at their task, the fisherman and his son came back to their net.
"What are you doing now?" shouted the fisherman. "Get away from my net!"
And with that, he started to throw a large harpoon at the walrus, who was cutting the net with his tusks. Without thinking of her own safety, Serendipity swam over to that boat, and with a mighty heave, she flipped it over, throwing the fisherman into the water. The fisherman was fluttering in the water, so Serendipity very carefully lifted them up and dropped them onto the overturned boat, where they hung on for dear life. In the meantime, the walrus had freed the old dolphin, and the three of them swam quickly away. "I am indebted to you," said the dolphin as they rested for a moment, "for saving me from the fisherman." The dolphin looked at Serendipity for a moment and said, "I know the walrus, for he is a cousin of mine, but the likes of you I've never seen."
"I don't know who or what I am," she said, "but the walrus is taking me to the island of Capri, where he says that all the fishes of all the world are meeting. They will decide what I should do."
"I, too, am on my way to Capri," said the dolphin. "But we must hurry, for we have a long journey and very little time." So once again, Serendipity, the walrus, and now the dolphin, set out for the island of Capri. They had swum for over 2 days, when suddenly the water began to turn dirty and brown. Paper cups and bottles bobbed in the sea around them. The farther they swam, the more garbage there seemed to be, and the oil floated freely on the top of the water.
"What is all this?" asked Serendipity.
"Unfortunately," said the dolphin, "we must swim close to the land on our journey, and the land dwellers throw their garbage into the sea." By this time, they were unable to move at all, because all of the garbage and junk floating in the water just impeded their way. "Would it not be wise to dive low and swim away from all this?" asked Serendipity. She looked a little silly, for she had a banana stuck on her nose.
"No," said the walrus. "Running away won't help the water or the fish that swim in it." Well, Serendipity over the past few days had grown bigger and bigger, until now she towered over the walrus and the dolphin. Because she was so big, she had more garbage and oil on her than the other two put together. To rid herself of all that dirt and grime, she began bobbing up and down in the water. By doing so, she created large waves that rolled onto the shore. Finally, she took one last dunk. She made such a large wave that it carried all of the oil, all of the garbage, and all that junk and threw it right up on the shore and on top of all the land dwellers who had thrown it into the sea to begin with. And the dolphin and the walrus laughed and cheered to see all that garbage leave the sea. Oh, serendipity, chuckled the walrus. I'm sure that those land dwellers will think very hard before they throw garbage into the sea again. Well, with the way clear before them, the walrus, the dolphin, and the proud serendipity once again set off for the island of Capri. After a long and tiring journey, they finally arrived at the island of Capri. There they found all the fishes of all the world. It was quite a sight to see. There were giant whales, tiny shrimp, chunky tunas, and slippery salmon, just to name a few. Well, we must leave you now, said the walrus and the dolphin, for we have much to do. And with that, they swam away from Serendipity into the milling crowds of fish.
Well, thought Serendipity, I'm never going to find out who or what I am by staying here. I must move to the front and ask the leaders of all the fishes.
She bumped and pushed her way to the front, and there, to her surprise, was the fat walrus and the old dolphin.
What are you two doing here?
She asked. We are the leaders of all the fishes, they answered.
But why haven't you told me before? I have come all this way only to find that you were the ones who could tell me who or what I am?
Serendipity, said the dolphin. We encountered many dangers on our trip, and you overcame all of them. In doing so, you have discovered that you are brave and kind, and that is what you are. As to who you are, said the walrus, you are Serendipity, and like your name, you always gain riches that you did not seek.
That is all well and good, said Serendipity, but now that I know who and what I am, what am I to do?
As you are now the largest of all the fishes of all the world, said the walrus and the dolphin, we hereby proclaim that you shall be the guardian of all the seas. It shall be your duty to protect the waters of the world from the land dwellers, and to make sure that the oceans stay clear and blue. Now, there's a moral to this story. Good stories usually have a moral one way or the other. If you ever throw your garbage in the ocean, lake, or sea, you'd better start to rowing, for there'll be Serendipity. You've been listening to a story from the book Serendipity by Stephen Cosgrove, published by the Serendipity Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Tom Hassler.
And now, it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Jean Tonell Stevens. Today I'll be reading the book Balder and the Mistletoe, retold by Margaret Hodges. When the world was young, the Norse gods lived in the golden city of Asgard. They could cross their rainbow bridge to the world of men. They could travel to the land of the frost giants and mountain giants. The gods could even reach the place of eternal ice and snow, the place of the dead. But no god wished to leave Asgard. Brightest and best of all the gods was Balder. Kind and beautiful, he was loved by gods and men. He understood the meaning of letters and the uses of healing herbs. His sweet wife, Nanna, loved him better than life. His blind brother, Hodur, followed him like a fond shadow. Only Loki, the mischief maker, was jealous of Balder and longed to destroy him. One night, Balder dreamed that he must soon leave Asgard. The next night and the next, he dreamed that he saw Hela, goddess of death, preparing her dark palace for some honored guest. He saw the whole world weeping, just as autumn mist and rain weep for the death of summer. Balder awoke pale and sad. He told his dreams to Sigga, his mother, and to Odin, his father, the All-Wise. There was only one way to learn whether Balder's dream spoke the truth. Odin mounted his eight-legged horse and left the golden towering palace of Valhalla. From Asgard, he took an untraveled road toward the northern ice. He heard the scream of seagulls blowing in from the stormy sea. He saw the black volcanic land, formed long ago by the hands of giants. Its mountains were crowned with snow that shone like gold under the diamond bright sky. Odin galloped on until he came to the land of eternal night, where the snow lies always. And he heard the rivers of Hel roaring. He saw Hel's misty hall, prepared for a feast. The benches were strewn with rings of gold, rich gifts for the expected guests. The tables were also spread with gold. Shields hung upon the wall, and Odin knew that these things were done to honor the coming of Balder. Sorrowfully, Odin returned to Asgard. But Sigga met him with joyful looks. "I have saved Balder," she said. "All things that touch the earth have promised never to harm our son. Fire will not burn him. Water will not drown him. Neither stone, nor iron, nor any other metal will cut or bruise him. No sickness, no poison will ever touch him. Trees and all creeping things have sworn the oath. See, the gods have gathered to prove that it is true." Odin saw Balder standing before the golden pillars of Valhalla with the other gods around him. Some, in play, threw spears at Balder. Others cast stones and axes. Nothing hit Balder. Stones fell at his feet. Spears and axes came aside when they came near him. Unharmed, Balder's brightness and beauty shone forth, and all the gods rejoiced. All except the jealous Loki. Loki took the form of an old woman clad in black, her face cold and white as snow. The woman went to Sigga's palace, saying, "The gods will surely kill your son." "Never," said Sigga. "All things have sworn an oath not to harm Balder." "All things?" asked the old woman. "All things that touch the earth," answered Sigga. "Only the mistletoe did not swear. It grows on a tree to the west of Asgard. The mistletoe does not touch the earth, and has no strength of its own. It is too young to take an oath, and too weak to hurt Balder." At once the woman turned away. Loki took his own form again, and searched until he found the mistletoe, its tiny waxen berries half hidden under the branches of a great oak tree. With a golden scythe, he cut down the mistletoe and caught it in a napkin. Then he returned to the gathering of the gods and made his way to blind Hodur, who stood alone outside the circus. "Why do you not honor Balder?" said Loki. "You too should throw something to prove that he cannot be hurt." "I cannot see him," Hodur answered, "and I have no weapon." Then Loki made an arrow of the mistletoe and sharpened the point. He breathed upon it, and the tender stem became hard.
He put the dart into the hand of Hodor. Take my arrow, said Loki. I will guide your hand. Straight flew the arrow, and Baldur the Beautiful fell dead, shot through the heart. The light faded from Asgard. The earth grew cold and still. Water turned to ice. Trees dropped their leaves. In the bare branches, birds no longer sang. And in the dark world of the dead, Hela greeted the spirit of her long-expected guest. Broken with grief, Hodor begged to take Baldur's place in hell, and Frigga set Hermod, the messenger, on Odin's horse to ask how Baldur might be released. Like a flash of lightning, Hermod sped downward from Asgard until he reached Hel's high gates. There he set spurs to his horse and leaped the gates into the kingdom of the dead. After 3 days, Hermod returned to Asgard with a word of hope. Hela has said that if all things reach for Baldur, she may go free. Frigga sent Hermod and all her messengers over the world to ask for tears, and everywhere tears fell. But Hermod, returning again to Asgard, came to a forest of iron trees. There, in a deep and rocky cavern, sat a hag, bent with age, her face hidden by a rough cloak. The spirit of Baldur the Beautiful is held prisoner in hell, until all things on earth shall weep for him, said the messenger. I ask for your tears. The old woman gave a loud laugh. Let Hela keep what she has. From under the cloak gleamed the malicious eyes of Loki. So, because there was one pair of dry eyes, Baldur the Beautiful could not return to Asgard. Nanna said nothing. Wrapped in silent sorrow, she held her dear lord in her arms, and so fell asleep. Frigga, by a kind, swift stroke, separated Nanna's spirit from her body, and set it free to follow the spirit of Baldur. For 12 days and nights, the gods labored to prepare a worthy funeral. On the seashore, they found Baldur's long ship, greatest of all ships, and brought logs from the forest to heap upon it. They placed Baldur in his shining armor on the pyre, with gentle Nanna by his side. Gods and giants watched and wondered as Odin knelt and whispered a word into the ear of his dead son. Then, with the torch, he kindled the fire. The giants gave a mighty thrust, which sent the ship far out on the waves. The flames rose higher and higher, as if they would set fire to heaven itself, and the black water shone like molten gold. At last, the brilliance faded to a glow of embers. On the far horizon, Baldur's burning ship sank beneath the waves, and darkness again covered the sea. With the death of Baldur came the twilight of the gods. Ages passed, and Baldur never returned. Then time swept away the old gods and the giants in one last battle with Loki and his evil powers. Loki, too, was destroyed. The ramparts of Asgard fell, worlds crashed in ruin, and the universe was no more. But out of chaos and dark night, a new heaven and a new earth were born. In the stars, day dawned again, as bright as the smile of Baldur the Beautiful. In northern lands, winter still brings a long darkness. But when the sun seems to have gone forever, and the mistletoe hangs on the bough, men remember Baldur. Then they light their fires, and live in the belief that Baldur will come again. For the word that Odin had whispered was hope. You've been listening to the story Baldur and the Mistletoe, retold by Margaret Hodges, published by Little Brown and Company. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella. And I'm June Canal Stevens.
The book.